All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 482 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about insulin. So we're going to call this the Clutch Insulin Podcast. I'm going to say this right off the bat. This podcast is probably one of the highest yield podcasts I've ever made. This stuff's pretty high yield, and there's a lot to go through, but I'll just say that this is something that you will see tested in some way or some derivative on step one, on step two, and on step three. And I'm going to try to make lots of integrations and try to break open some things that may confuse people as we go along. So obviously we know that insulin, you know, if they give you a question about like a young child and this child has been having polydipsia and polyuria for the last few days, and then the child is somnolent, is short of breath, has skin tinting, has dry mucous membranes, and then they give you the child's blood glucose and it's like 700, and the child's bicarb is like 10, and the child's pH is like 7.23 or something like that, then that child is clearly in DKA, and this child is presenting with type 1 diabetes. So how do we treat type 1 diabetes? Obviously, we're going to treat that with insulin. Remember, insulin is not usually what you start with in type 2 diabetes. And when a person has type 2 diabetes, you start with many of the other drugs, the oral stuff, metformin, the sulfonylureas, the thiazolidinediones, the SGLT2 inhibitors that end in flozin, you know, all those drugs. But if all that is no longer obtaining good control, many times people that have type 2 diabetes, terminally, they're going to have to switch to insulin. So what's the whole deal with insulin? Well, the thing is, again, there are just many critical things to know about insulin for the exam. First thing is that it's a hormone, right? And we all know that insulin is a peptide hormone. It's not a steroid hormone, right? It's a peptide hormone. That's actually very important. Now, where do we make insulin from? Well, insulin is made from the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. It's made from the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. And it's actually pretty high yield to understand that these beta cells, they are centrally located in the islet of Langerhans. The alpha cells that make glucagon, which essentially does like the opposite of what insulin does, are located on the periphery in the islets of Langerhans. The thing is, insulin, as it's being secreted from the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans, on its way out of that islet of Langerhans, pretty much inhibits the alpha cell so that they do not secrete glucagon. Because you don't want to be secreting a ton of insulin and then secreting a ton of glucagon at the same time, because they literally do the opposite things. You don't want to keep a futile cycle. So that's why the alpha cells that make glucagon, they're on the periphery. As insulin is leaving the islets, it's going to shut down the alpha cells from making a glucagon. Now, do you want to think of insulin as an anabolic or as a catabolic hormone? Well, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, it's more of an anabolic hormone, right? Insulin is a hormone that builds people up. It doesn't tear people down. It is not catabolic. It is anabolic, right? In fact, if you see people that have been on long-term insulin therapy, many times they can get obese because insulin is almost like a growth factor. In fact, I'm sure many of you have heard of this insulin-like growth factor, blah, 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 right? Insulin is a growth factor. It builds people up, right? It takes molecules from being small to being large, right? It takes free fatty acids and makes triglycerides from those. It takes peptides and makes proteins from those. It takes glucose and makes glycogen from it, right? And one of the main roles, in fact, I'll say this is probably the primary role of insulin, is that insulin helps you get glucose into your muscle cells, your adipocytes, your liver. Insulin is necessary for your cells to uptake the glucose that is in the blood, right? And again, insulin helps with many things. Again, I said it's anabolic, so it helps with glycogen synthesis. So it takes glucose monomers and puts them together to form glycogen. It helps with lipogenesis, right? So it takes all your free fatty acids, takes your glycerol, and esterifies them into forming triglycerides, right? And insulin also inhibits glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis. So if something want, if insulin is to help you make glycogen, then it doesn't make sense for it to promote the breakdown of that glycogen that has just formed, right? So insulin inhibits glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis, right? And what is one of the primary stimulants of the release of insulin? Well, one of the primary stimulants is going to be high blood glucose. Whenever your blood glucose is high, your body is like, whoa, this is not good. We need to get some of this glucose into cells, into critical cells like your muscle cells, your adipocytes, your liver. So insulin is going to be released heavily in response to that, right? It's going to be released heavily in response to that. And if you look at the hormone that does the opposite job of insulin, glucagon. Well, glucagon, again, as I said, come from the alpha cells in the islets of Langerhans. And that glucagon, its release is stimulated by low blood glucose. If your blood glucose is low, then you don't want, you want the liver to supply glucose to the bloodstream so your cells can have adequate glucose. So when your blood glucose is low, you're going to increase the release of glucagon. So just like insulin suppresses blood glucose levels, glucagon increases blood glucose levels. So it shouldn't be a huge surprise to you that if a person has a glucagonoma, they're going to have diabetes. Why? Because that glucagonoma is going to cause them to have very high blood glucose levels. Now, as many of us know, there are two kinds of diabetes, right? You know, there's type 1 diabetes, there's type 2 diabetes, at least on a simplistic level for the USMLEs, which is completely fine. In type 1 diabetes, right, it's pretty much an autoimmune disease. You have autoimmune destruction of your pancreatic beta islet cells, right? And when you have that autoimmune destruction, you know, with these anti-insulin or anti-islet polypeptide or anti-GAD, right, anti-glutamate decarboxylase antibodies, then you're not going to be able to make insulin. So people that have type 1 diabetes, they have an insulin deficiency. Now, people that have type 2 diabetes, right, as many of us know, it's more of an insulin resistance problem, right? And many times, people that have type 2 diabetes, they accumulate amyloid within their beta islet cells. And that amyloid, those aggregated beta plated sheets, right? Remember, sometimes our friends at the USMLEs, they love to test protein structure, especially on step one. Those aggregated beta plated sheets, you know, those amyloids, they pretty much distort the proper functioning of those beta islet cells. That's why at some point, people that have type 2 diabetes are going to require exogenous insulin, right? That amyloid that accumulates in type 2 diabetes is made of amylin, A-M-Y-L-I-N, amylin, right? And you may wonder, again, where does this amylin come from? The thing is, amylin is also secreted from the pancreatic beta islet cells. Whenever you secrete insulin, you also secrete amylin as well. The problem with people that have type 2 diabetes is they have a lot of insulin resistance. So early in the course of their disease, they release very huge amounts of insulin because the body is kind of resistant to it. And I'll talk about some potential mechanisms behind that resistance. But as they're releasing all that insulin, they're also releasing huge amounts of amylin. Whenever that amylin is released in huge quantity, your body's like, man, this thing is like so much. So it's going to start heaping it up. And you're going to start forming these aggregated beta-plated sheets that ultimately become our amyloid, right? And insulin, if you look at it from the structural perspective, right, it pretty much has like an A chain and a B chain, right? And that A and B chain, they are connected by disulfide bonds, okay? They're connected by disulfide bonds. So if you actually want to break up the structure of insulin, if you want to degrade insulin, you need to break down disulfide bonds. Again, remember, the USMLEs, they love disulfide bonds. Do not lose sight of your famous disulfide bonds, right? So like, for example, we know that N-acetylcysteine can be used in people that have cystic fibrosis to break up their mucus plugs. Why? Because it breaks up what? Disulfide bonds. Don't lose sight of what? Disulfide bonds. Something you love to test on step one. Now, one weird factoid I think I want to discuss with insulin that, you know, you may see it show up out of the blue on an exam. You may be scratching your head that, man, I've never seen this stuff. I've never seen this stuff before anywhere. Is our friends at the USMLEs, every now and then they love to test like weird transcription factors. You just wonder, like, how did they pick this question out of a hat, right? And usually, almost like without fail, People just guess on these questions, and most people get them wrong, right? So there's one transcription factor I want you to commit to memory for your USMLE exams that is very high yield in the synthesis of insulin, in you transcribing the gene that codes for insulin, and that's PDX1. PDX1. I promise you need to burn this into your brain for the USMLEs. PDX1 is a critical transcription factor for the production of insulin. It's kind of similar to how the USMLEs love to test the FOXP3. You know, if you have any kind of USMLE experience, you've probably heard of FOXP3. FOXP3 is a transcription factor that is necessary for the proper functioning of regulatory T cells. Right? So again, if they can give you like one of these experiment-based questions, especially on step one, where they tell you that, oh, which of the following will happen in a state of high blood glucose? Well, guess what? You're going to upregulate the transcription factor PDX1 in that situation of high blood glucose, right? Because again, if you upregulate that transcription factor, you'll make more insulin, and that more insulin will help you deal with that high blood glucose problem that you have, right? It'll make you deal with that high blood glucose problem that you have, right? So the thing is, we know that blood glucose should be maintained in some kind of homeostasis, right? You don't want your blood glucose to be high all the time. When your blood glucose is high all the time, it starts causing many problems in the body, right? It starts damaging your kidneys, damaging your eyes, damaging your neurons, causing many of the antecedents of diabetes, right? So you want your blood glucose to be maintained in homeostasis. You don't want it to be too high where you have hyperglycemia because it causes problems. I also don't want it to be too low where you have hypoglycemia that can kill you. Actually, hypoglycemia, honestly, is more dangerous than hyperglycemia. I'm going to say that again. Hypoglycemia is actually, in fact, more dangerous than hyperglycemia. So, because if you think about it, if your blood glucose is high all the time, you know, you're going to keep upregulating this transcription factor PDX1. But the thing is, if you're just making so much of this transcription factor all the time, the target of this transcription factor, its different targets, are not going to be as sensitive to PDX1 anymore. They're not going to bind PDX1 as well anymore, right? And if they don't bind PDX1 as well anymore, that can begin to cause problems with insulin production. And if you don't make enough insulin, you're not going to be able to deal with that high blood glucose problem. So having high blood glucose is actually not a good thing, right? And I like to give this analogy. Think about it. Let's say you really love, I'm going to say this as a Nigerian. Let's say you really love fried rice, plantain, and chicken. And then you keep eating fried rice, plantain, and chicken. You eat it breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. At some point, as much as you love fried rice, plantain, and chicken, you're going to get tired of it. You're going to get sick and fed up of it. And you're like, no, I do not want fried rice, plantain, and chicken anymore. That thing you loved so much, your affinity for it goes down precipitously. Why? Because you've just had way too much of it. So if your blood glucose is high all the time and you're making PDX1 all the time, the targets of PDX1 are not going to be very pleased with PDX1 anymore. And if you're not pleased with PDX1 anymore, that's one of the situations where you begin to make less insulin. This actually kind of explains why people that have type 2 diabetes, over time, because they usually have just high blood glucose. Over time, PDX1 will not be as sensitive as it should be, and these people are going to start making less insulin. At that point, they're going to start needing exogenous insulin. And actually, one other thing that many people taking the USMLEs are completely unaware of is that glucose actually can lead to the formation of free radicals. I'm going to say that again. Glucose, in a time-dependent fashion, can induce oxidative stress. It can lead to the formation of free radicals, especially in pancreatic beta cells, because pancreatic beta cells, they bring in huge amounts of glucose, right? And if you have those free radicals popping up, that can actually lead to the destruction of these pancreatic beta cells, and it can actually lead to their subsequent apoptosis. And this can cause problems. So again, having high blood glucose all the time is not a good thing. I promise you, it's not a good thing. That's why when a physician is saying, oh, what's your diet? keep the carbs low, exercise, so you don't get in trouble. They're not saying it for fun. They're actually saying it for good reason. So we've kind of talked about the genetic thing with insulin, talking about PDX1. Again, you're like, man, Divine, you spend way too much time on PDX1. I wish you all the best. When you see an exam question, you're like, gee, they're spending so much time on PDX1. Again, I'm not talking about it because I love to hear myself talk. Now we've talked about it at the genetic level. How is insulin made? Well, insulin, you know, when you make the mRNA, you're going to translate that mRNA and you're going to form pre-proinsulin, right? You're going to form pre-proinsulin. That pre-proinsulin has to go into the endoplasmic reticulum. The thing is really making this insulin podcast, one of the reasons I chose insulin as a topic is that there are so many integrations you can make with insulin. Literally, there are tons and tons and tons of integrations that you can make with insulin. There are just many ways you can cut into cell biology, cut into genetics, cut into biochemistry, cut into pharmacology, cut into metabolism, many different things. So think of this as almost like a podcast that will help you deal with a section like multi-systems processes and disorders on your USMLE exams. Right? So insulin is made as pre-proinsulin, and then that pre-proinsulin has to be taken into the rough endoplasmic reticulum, right? And remember, the rough endoplasmic reticulum, right, has this thing called signal peptidase, right? A peptidase is means it cuts out a peptide, right? So it cuts out the signal peptide, because the signal peptide is the thing that gets insulin from the cytosol into the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So that signal peptidase is going to cut away the signal peptide. And once you cut away that signal peptide, that pre-proinsulin becomes pro-insulin. And that pro-insulin starts folding in the endoplasmic reticulum, and then it continues on its way to the Golgi apparatus. After going through the Golgi apparatus, right? Remember, the Golgi apparatus has the cis-Golgi network and the trans-Golgi network. It's going to be packaged into secretory vesicles, right? And then when it's packaged into secretory vesicles, it's then pretty much waiting to be released when the right signals come along, right? When the right signals come along. And the thing is, when you're about to release insulin, typically you're going to actually like cut out the middle part of the insulin molecule, which is the C-peptide, right? Many of us are familiar with C-peptide. So how do you think our friends at the USMLEs will love to test C-peptide? Well, let me explain. The thing is, before insulin is released, like I said, from those vesicles, the C-peptide part, which is like the middle portion, is cut off. So whenever insulin is released, C-peptide is going to be released as well. So think about it. If a person has an insulinoma, you have a tumor, right? Usually you're going to find this in a person that has MEN1. Because remember, people that have MEN1, they have parathyroid problems, pancreatic problems, you know, pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, and pituitary adenomas. These people are going to release, they can have insulinomas. It's one of these pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors that can make a ton of insulin. That insulin can cause problems, right? So you notice this person keeps having whippostride. You know, they have hypoglycemia, they have signs of hypoglycemia, and then their symptoms magically improve with the administration of glucose, you know, like fruit juice or whatever, right? So the reason they have that hypoglycemia is this tumor is pumping out tons and tons and tons of insulin, right? So one of the ways you can see that, man, this person has an insulinoma is that you're going to notice that their insulin levels are very high, but their C-peptide levels are also high as well. Now, let me ask you this. How about a person that's taking a sulfonylurea? Well, sulfonylureas, they make you secrete more insulin. We're going to talk about how insulin is secreted, but they make you secrete more insulin. So guess what? Because sulfonylureas make you secrete more insulin from your endogenous, so that means from within your pancreatic beta cells stores, right? It's also going to raise your insulin and your C-peptide levels. So how do you differentiate between a person that is taking a sulfonylurea and a person that has an insulinoma? Well, the way you're going to differentiate is that both will be associated with increased insulin, both will be associated with increased C-peptide, but there's something known as a secretagogue screen, A secretagogue screen is like a blood test for a sulfonylurea. The secretagogue screen is going to be positive when you're taking a sulfonylurea, but it's going to be negative in a person that has an insulinoma. That's very important. And then the third kind of thing you may want to keep in mind with C-peptide is, what if a person is exogenously, so that means like taking something on the outside, not something their body is producing. They're exogenously taking insulin, maybe to create hypoglycemic symptoms. Maybe they have like Munchausen's or something weird like that. Then in that circumstance, those people's insulin will be high. They'll have signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia, but their C-peptide levels will be almost non-existent. Well, why is that? Well, the thing is, if you're taking a ton of exogenous insulin, First things first, exogenous insulin does not contain C-peptide at all. The insulin you can buy at a drugstore, you know, not buy, at least not in the US. I gotta get a prescription for those. The insulin you can get from a drugstore does not contain C-peptide. Exogenous insulin does not contain C-peptide. So as you're taking that insulin, right, your insulin levels are going to be high, but your C-peptide is going to be like non-existent because that insulin you're taking in your body is going to induce a hypoglycemia. That hypoglycemia is going to suppress insulin production. So your endogenous stores of insulin, your pancreatic beta cells are going to see the hypoglycemia and say, whoa, we better not make any insulin at all. So even your own pancreas, your beta islet cells, are not going to be making insulin. And if they're not making insulin, they're not going to be making C-peptide as well, right? That's actually pretty important to understand. So when you're exogenously taking insulin, your insulin will be high and your C-peptide will be low, right? Because again, that exogenous insulin you're taking first, there are two reasons why you don't have a high C-peptide. That exogenous insulin you're taking first does not contain C-peptide at all. But that exogenous insulin is also going to suppress your blood glucose. When you suppress your blood glucose, that is a very powerful suppressant of insulin production. Because think about if you're hypoglycemic, you don't want to make more insulin. Because if you make more insulin, you're going to lower your blood glucose even more and die. Your body does not want that, right? So your body, if you're taking so much exogenous insulin, your endogenous insulin production will be suppressed, right? That's also going to suppress C-peptide production. Okay, so now that you've made insulin, packaged it in these vesicles, how in the world do you secrete that insulin? Well, you're going to secrete insulin in two phases. Insulin is secreted in two phases. There's an initial rapid phase, usually within the first like 10 minutes, and then there's a sustained slow release that happens over the subsequent 2 to 3 hours, right? So let's maybe break this down again at the biochemical level. How do you release insulin? How do you secrete out insulin from your beta cells in the islets of Langerhans? Well, the first thing that happens is that glucose is going to enter the pancreatic beta islet cell through what? GLUT2 transporters. GLUT2 transporters. Remember, GLUT2 transporters, they are bidirectional. They can let glucose go in either direction. Literally, it just works by concentration gradients, okay? They are bidirectional. Remember the two for bidirectional, right? So you find these GLUT2 transporters, you're going to find them in the pancreatic beta islet cells. You're going to find them in the liver as well, right? So when glucose enters the pancreatic beta islet cells through the GLUT2 transporter, glucokinase is going to convert that glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, right? So the more glucose you have entering the cell, the more glucose 6-phosphate you also have as well, right? And many of us know that the GLUT2 transporter has a high KM and a high Vmax, right? So it doesn't have a high affinity for glucose, but it has a very high capacity. It has a very, very high Vmax. Okay. Remember, the higher your KM, the lower your affinity. The lower your KM, the higher your affinity. Just thought I should throw in that Michaelis-Menten integration here, right? So the more glucose enters these beta islet cells, the more glucose 6-phosphate you have, right? And remember that glucose 6-phosphate does not inhibit glucokinase like it does hexokinase. Hexokinase is inhibited by its product, glucose 6-phosphate. Glucokinase is not inhibited by its product, glucose 6-phosphate. That's another weird but high-yield thing to know. Like many of these things you see me say in this podcast, you may be like, wow, Divine, these are nameless details. I promise you, for step one, many of these things are very important. And some of these things, not all of them, but some of these things are absolutely important for step two and step three. They're absolutely important for step two and step three. Some, not all. Some, not all. This detailed cell bio stuff, probably more for step one. But there are some things you're going to hear me say in this podcast that are coming down the line and I've said already that are certainly for step two and step three, right? So this glucose 6-phosphate, right, obviously is going to go down glycolysis and do all the glycolysis, TCA cycle, electron transport chain. It's going to create ATP, right? And as ATP is created, what's going to happen to the ATP to ADP ratio within the cell? Well, it's obviously going to rise. Your ATP to ADP ratio within the cell is going to rise. And those high levels of ATP are going to close potassium channels, right? And when you close these potassium channels, it's going to prevent prevent potassium from leaking out of the cell by facilitated diffusion. If potassium does not leak out of the cell anymore, then it's going to start accumulating. And potassium is a positive charge. So as it accumulates, it's going to cause the cell to depolarize. And when the cell depolarizes, there are some channels that will open, voltage-gated channels. Remember, a voltage-gated channel is a channel that opens in response to a change in voltage. This is different from a ligand-gated channel that opens in response to the binding of a ligand, right? So because the cell depolarizes, the voltage-gated calcium channels, right? One of the voltage-gated channels that opens is a voltage-gated calcium channel. It's going to open and calcium is going to rush into the cell by facilitated diffusion, right? As calcium rushes into the cell, this is going to trigger the release of insulin from secretory vesicles. Okay, it's going to trigger the release of insulin from secretory vesicles. And these potassium channels that I said that are blocked by ATP, those are actually the targets of sulfonylureas. Sulfonylureas actually block those potassium channels as well, which will again prevent potassium leaking out of the pancreatic beta islet cell by facilitated diffusion. That's going to cause the cell to depolarize, and then you're going to again open up these voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium is going to rush into the cell, and then insulin is going to be released from secretory vesicles. Okay, insulin is going to be released from secretory vesicles. Again, very, very, very important to know, right? Because again, remember, if you block a potassium channel, potassium normally is an intracellular ion, right? Because if you think about it, potassium, your sodium potassium ATPase pumps takes three sodiums out of the cell and puts two potassiums into the cell, right? Remember, the sodium potassium ATPase pump consumes like 70% of the energy of any cell. So it constantly puts potassium into cells. So potassium builds up to a higher level within cells, okay? So normally the natural place that potassium wants to flow to is flow out of the cell, right? On its own, right? Because there is much higher concentrations in the cell than outside. Right? But if you block those channels, potassium will not leak out. The cell will depolarize. It's going to open up voltage-gated channels like the voltage-gated calcium channel. Calcium is going to rush in, and then those secretory vessels are going to release insulin. Okay? They're going to release insulin. So if you think about this, if you understand the way insulin is released, it should then make logical sense to you that anything that increases the amount of intracellular calcium should also increase the release of insulin. Right. In fact, if you think about it, if you've learned about your G protein coupled receptors, you probably know that there are three major types of G protein coupled receptors tested on the USMLEs. There's the GS, you know, the stimulatory G protein coupled receptors, like your beta 1, beta 2. There's your GI, they are your inhibitory G protein coupled receptors, you know, like your alpha 2 receptors. And then there's your GQ, G protein coupled receptor. So the one we're going to focus on today is the GQ, G protein coupled receptor. How does this work? Basically, the way this works is that phospholipase C is going to cleave something known as PIP2. I think it's called like phosphoinositol 4,5 bisphosphate. It's going to cleave PIP2 into IP3. That's inositol triphosphate and DAG. DAG means diisoglycerol, right? IP3 is going to go to the endoplasmic reticulum and it's going to cause the release of calcium into the cytosol, right? And obviously, think about it. If you release calcium into the cytosol, basically, if there is more calcium in the cytosol, that's going to trigger insulin release. So if you understand this, then it should pretty much help you understand how the parasympathetic system causes insulin release. The parasympathetic system actually in that rest and digest phase actually causes a release of insulin. Well, if you think about it, there are two key muscarinic receptors. I mean, there are many, but if you think of the M1 and the M3 muscarinic receptors, those are GQ, G protein coupled receptors. So because they are GQ, G protein coupled receptors, they do this PIP2, IP3, release more calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum business, right? So because they cause more intracellular calcium to accumulate, it actually makes sense that they're going to increase your release of insulin, And then honestly, if you want to throw in another integration here, many people memorize that, thiazides cause hyperglycemia. Ooh, hyperglucemic with thiazides. Many people have memorized that stuff. Well, how do you think thiazides cause many of those problems? Remember this potassium channel I just mentioned? The thing is, thiazides love to open potassium channels. I'm going to say that again. Thiazides love to open potassium channels. So think about it. If you're a potassium channel opener, what potassium channel have we talked about already today? Gee, we've talked about the potassium channels in the beta cells of the islets of Langerhans, right? If you open up those potassium channels, more potassium will leak out from the intracellular environment of the pancreatic beta cells. If more potassium leaks out, then those cells are not going to depolarize. If those cells don't depolarize, voltage-gated calcium channels will not open. If calcium does not enter, then you will not release insulin. So thiazides, since they open potassium channels, they actually lower your release of insulin. If you lower your release of insulin, are you going to be able to deal with your blood glucose problem? No, you're going to have hyperglycemia. If you lower your release of insulin, are you going to be able to store fat within adipocytes? No. So those fats will literally stay in your bloodstream, You're going to get hyperlipidemia. That's the reason, that's one pathophase behind why thiazide diuretics cause hyperglycemia and cause hyperlipidemia. Okay, now, one other thing I want to say about the release of insulin or the secretion of insulin is that insulin is not released at a continuous high level. It is not released at a continuous high level. It's actually released in an oscillatory fashion. So you release high amounts, then low amounts, and then back to high, and then back to low. Why is this important to understand? The thing is, if you released insulin at a continuously high level, that will actually cause a downregulation of the insulin receptor. Again, remember, I've mentioned this concept already that, the more you get exposed to something you love, the more heat you begin to build up for that thing you love, right? So if insulin is released at a continuously high level, that's actually going to cause a downregulation of the insulin receptor. And by the way, the insulin receptor is a tyrosine kinase receptor. I'll talk about that later, right? But the thing is, if insulin receptors are downregulated, that will reduce your response to insulin. If you don't have insulin receptors around to respond to insulin, then you're going to start having some kind of insulin resistance. So think about it. Can you see how insulin resistance can develop in a type 2 diabetic? Because think about it. People that have type 2 diabetes, they have, their bodies are almost like, they always have high blood glucose. So guess what? Over time, the pancreatic beta cells are going to just be releasing high amounts of insulin. But those high amounts of insulin that are being released all the time, it's going to cause a downregulation of insulin receptors. If you have a downregulation of insulin receptors, then you're not going to be getting that insulin effect. So you're going to have a worsening and a worsening of your hyperglycemia. And the more hyperglycemia you have, the more glucose enters through those GLUT2 transporters into the pancreatic beta islet cells. And the more insulin you make, and then the more insulin you make, the more downregulation of those insulin receptors you'll have. So it's almost like you have this self-fulfilling prophecy that keeps making the condition worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, right? In fact, let me tell you this. There's a reason why insulin dosing in diabetics is done in interval form. You don't see a diabetic taking insulin all the day long. No, if they did that, their insulin receptors in their bodies will be downregulated, and that's going to be a huge, huge, huge problem for them. So insulin dosing in diabetics is actually done in an interval. You basically get you have this insulin you take with meals, and then you have this long-acting insulin that gives you like a basal low level all throughout the day, right? So the thing is, again, many things in life or many things in medicine, people just memorize, but many times there's actually a reason behind the stuff that is done. Okay, so now that we've talked about, insulin release, let's talk about the things that stimulate the release of insulin, right? So again, as I've said already, if you have high blood glucose, that's going to cause you to release more insulin. Obviously, right, makes sense to help you lower your blood glucose levels. Beta-2, if you stimulate beta-2 receptors, that's actually going to cause you to release more insulin. And then certain amino acids like leucine and arginine actually cause you to release more insulin. And then there are things known as incretins, right? So like GLP-1 and GIP, right? GLP-1 is one, and then GIP, like glucose, I think derived insulinotropic peptide or something like that. But just remember, GLP-1, GIP, they're incretins. They're actually things released in the GI tract that actually help you make more insulin, right? So if you've heard of the GLP-1 agonists, those are diabetes drugs, right? So things like exenatide or liraglutide, those things actually cause you to release more endogenous insulin, right? So if you're taking exenatide or liraglutide, it should make sense that your insulin levels and your C-peptide levels should be elevated. Why am I saying all of this? I'm saying all of this because many people just say, the only drugs that can raise my insulin and C-peptide are the sulfonylureas. No, the other drugs that do that, like your GLP-1 agonists, also do that. And then there are these drugs known as the meglitinides. right? So drugs like repaglinide or nateglinide, they pretty much work like sulfonylureas. They're just shorter acting, right? All those things are going to raise your levels of insulin and C-peptide. Those things are going to raise your levels of insulin and C-peptide, right? Again, you have to be living under a rock to not have heard of Ozempic, right? It's a GLP-1 agonist, right? You know, many people use it these days for weight loss. Actually, I think it's been approved by the FDA for weight loss. But again, just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what are some things that inhibit insulin release? Well, if your blood glucose is low, that's going to inhibit insulin release. We've talked about that. If you actually stimulate alpha-2 receptors, so if you take an alpha-2 agonist, like clonidine, for example, that's actually going to lower your production of insulin. Okay, now let's talk about the insulin receptor in a little more detail. Again, this is one of those things that you may see as an offhanded question on step 3, or it may show up as a pretty detailed question on step 1, right? So the insulin receptor is a tyrosine kinase receptor, right? Basically, when insulin binds to this receptor, the tyrosine kinase portion of it is going to autophosphorylate. And as it autophosphorylates, it's then going to begin to phosphorylate things in the cell known as insulin receptor substrates, right? It's a tyrosine kinase. Kinases add phosphates to things, okay? It's going to begin to phosphorylate things in the cell known as insulin receptor substrates, right? And as you phosphorylate insulin receptor substrates, we're going to start seeing effects of insulin, okay? But I want to make something abundantly clear in your mind. Please, like, this thing I'm about to say, burn this into your brain for as long as you humanly can. So, insulin, its initial actions involve phosphorylation, right? Through this tyrosine kinase receptor, right? It's literally a receptor that activates tyrosine kinases, right? It's going to add phosphate to things. But the true downstream effect of insulin is dephosphorylation. I'm going to say this again. The true downstream, like final effect of insulin is dephosphorylation, right? The tyrosine kinase receptor does all its autophosphorylations and everything. But the true downstream effects of insulin is dephosphorylation. I promise you, if you understand this fact, a lot of the regulation in biochemistry and metabolic pathways that people memorize, you absolutely don't need to do any of those memorizations. Please burn this into your brain and it will make your life profoundly simple. Insulin is a dephosphorylator. Insulin activates things by dephosphorylating them. I'm going to say that again. Insulin activates things by dephosphorylating them. You're going to see me make a few integrations with this as we slowly begin to come to the end of this podcast, right? Now, one other offhanded factoid I want to throw in there with the insulin receptor is that, you know, insulin has many tasks, right? But two tasks have like a particular signaling cascade that you need to know for your USMLEs, and that's glycogen synthesis and GLUT4 insertion into the membranes of like your adipocytes and your skeletal muscle cells. That's actually done by the PI3 kinase pathway. When insulin, you know, activates this PI3 kinase pathway, it's going to cause you to put more GLUT4 transporters on the surfaces of adipocytes and skeletal muscle cells. And it also, again, it's going to cause you to activate glycogen synthesis. Right? So let's maybe go ahead and summarize this. What are the critical functions of insulin? Well, insulin induces glucokinase in the liver, right? Glucokinase is going to convert glucose to glucose-6-phosphate in the liver, right? And also in the pancreatic beta cells. But that glucose-6-phosphate can then go down many pathways in glycogen synthesis, right? Insulin activates PFK2. PFK2 is something that makes a product known as fructose-2,6-bisphosphate. Fructose-2,6-bisphosphate is a very powerful activator of PFK1. PFK1 is the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis. I'm going to say that again. PFK1 is the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis. Okay? PFK1 can be activated by fructose-2,6-bisphosphate. Fructose-2,6-bisphosphate is made by PFK2. Insulin activates PFK2. So let me ask you this. PFK2, the active form, will it be an enzyme that is phosphorylated or an enzyme that is dephosphorylated? Well, I would hope you're telling me that, oh, Divine, the active form of PFK2 is the dephosphorylated form. Again, insulin wants you glycolysis to run. Insulin is a glycolysis activator. Okay, insulin is a glycolysis activator. So insulin activates PFK2. I said that insulin is a dephosphorylator. That's its downstream effect. So that means the dephosphorylated form of PFK2 has to be the active form. And if PFK2 is active, you'll make more fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. If you make more fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, you're going to activate PFK1. If you activate PFK1, you're going to make more, you're going to upregulate glycolysis, right? So again, it dephosphorylates and activates PFK2, right? Which we use to make fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, which is a stimulator of PFK1, which is the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis, right? And then insulin also dephosphorylates and activates pyruvate dehydrogenase, right? Remember, the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex deals with the pyruvate that comes from glycolysis. And then insulin also activates acetyl-CoA carboxylase. It activates acetyl-CoA carboxylase. And that's actually the rate-limiting enzyme of fatty acid synthesis. And then insulin induces the genetic expression of fatty acid synthase, or fatty acid synthase, which again is helpful in the synthesis of fatty acids and triglycerides, right? And then, again, as I've said many times, insulin upregulates GLUT4 targeting to the membranes of your adipocytes and skeletal muscle cells, so that those kinds of cells can take up blood glucose, right? And then insulin also activates glycogen synthase. It dephosphorylates glycogen synthase, right? And when it dephosphorylates glycogen synthase, it's going to make glycogen synthase active, so you can make glycogen. I promise you, like many people, they spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours memorizing a lot of regulation in biochemistry. But they won't have to do any of those things if they just remember two simple rules. Insulin is a dephosphorylator. Glucagon is a phosphorylator. I'm going to say that again. Insulin is a dephosphorylator. Glucagon is a phosphorylator. I'm going to say that again. Insulin is a dephosphorylator. Glucagon is a phosphorylator. So that means that if you're dealing with a process that involves insulin and there are enzymes in that process that need to be active for that process to work, and insulin regulates those enzymes, you automatically can know that the dephosphorylated forms of those enzymes are the active forms. But if a process like lipolysis, for example, or gluconeogenesis, for example, we know that those processes are activated by glucagon. And we know that glucagon is a phosphorylator. So since glucagon is a phosphorylator, that tells you that, oh, the active form of those enzymes that are involved in those pathways that glucagon promotes have to be the phosphorylated forms of those enzymes. Okay. Now, what are a few more high-yield things that insulin does? Well, insulin does things like activating cholesterol synthesis, right? It shuts down lipolysis, right? Insulin wants you to make triglycerides, not break them down, right? Insulin also shuts down glycogenolysis, right? Because again, you don't want to be breaking down the glycogen you've just made, right? And insulin also inhibits autophagy. Autophagy is actually a process that helps you remove and degrade poorly functioning cells. Basically, like garbage in your body can be degraded and safely gotten rid of by autophagy, right? Insulin inhibits autophagy, right? So this can actually kind of tell you why fasting can be very beneficial. Fasting suppresses insulin production, because think about it. If you're fasting, you're in a low blood glucose state. If you're in a low blood glucose state, then you're not going to be making insulin. If you're not making insulin, then autophagy will not be suppressed. That's why you see some people, they fast and then they kind of start getting healed from like weird stuff, because autophagy is being upregulated. But that's a deeper discussion. That's not appropriate for this podcast. And then another thing that insulin does is that it activates the sodium potassium ATPase pump. It activates the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So you can actually use insulin to acutely lower a person's blood potassium levels, right? So if a person has like hyperkalemia and they're very symptomatic, right? Remember, many times you're going to see like tall peak T waves. You're going to see a white QRS. First thing you're going to do is give calcium gluconate to stabilize the myocardium, right? But after doing that, one thing you can actually give that's helpful is insulin. And give insulin, because insulin is going to upregulate a person's the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. And as I've said already in this podcast, that pump brings 3 sodiums out of the cell and puts 2 potassiums into the cell. As you put those potassiums into the cell, you're basically redistributing potassium. So the person's blood potassium levels will go down. Although many times when you're giving that insulin, you're going to give glucose as well, because that insulin you're giving the person is tanking their glucose. You don't want them to go into a hypoglycemic crisis and die in addition to their hyperkalemia. Okay, so what are the organs that help us get rid of insulin? Well, insulin can be degraded and cleared by the liver and by the kidneys, right? Another high yield factoid to know about insulin is that insulin, when your insulin is very high, it actually messes up surfactant synthesis. So if you're an infant of a diabetic mom, you can see why infants of diabetic moms are prone to respiratory distress syndrome. Because think about it, if you're an infant of a diabetic mom, your mom has a ton of diabetes, right? Well, or has diabetes, right? Your mom has high blood glucose levels. Well, through the placenta, the fetus is also going to be seeing those high blood glucose levels. So the fetal beta islet cells are going to make a ton of insulin to deal with that high blood glucose, right? That ton of insulin that we see in these in the fetal bloodstream is going to suppress surfactant synthesis in that fetus, right? So when that fetus is born, that fetus may not have enough surfactant, right? That's why being an infant of a diabetic mom has a strong association with respiratory distress syndrome, okay? Has a strong association with respiratory distress syndrome. And then remember that, you know, insulin resistance is not just in type 2 diabetes. It's something we also find a lot in PCOS. And then the final thing I'm going to say about insulin, I promise, and I'm done. Make sure you know the types of insulin, right? There are many types of insulin. There's the rapid-acting insulins like Lispro, Aspart, and Glulysine. Lispro, Aspart, and Glulysine, right? These are the ones you take with meals. And then there's the intermediate insulin, you know, NPH. I think NPH means like neutral protamine hargadon or something like that. But basically, it's the one that you have to dose twice a day. It's just a cheaper form of insulin. The thing is, ideally, you want to be using these rapid-acting insulins I just mentioned and the long-acting insulins you take once a day, right? Like glargine. I think glargine is the one that's called Lantus, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, glargine, Dedamir, and Degludec. Those are the long-acting insulins, right? So, in general, a diabetic's regimen, you want a long-acting insulin you take once a day, and these rapid-acting insulins you take with meals. So you want to be taking like glargine, Dedamir, or Degludec like once a day, and then Lispro, Aspart, or Glulysine with your meals. But, you know, these glargine, Dedamir, Degludec, they're very expensive. So sometimes some people, the good middle ground is, you know what, I'll be taking these rapid-acting insulins with meals, but I'll be taking NPH, this intermediate-acting insulin, twice a day. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. Again, I know this is one of probably the longest podcasts I've made, but I promise you this is probably one of the highest yield podcasts I've made. There's definitely some key nuggets here for people taking step 2 and step 3, but for people taking step 1, pretty much everything I've said in this podcast you need to know. I'm going to say that again. If you're taking step 1, pretty much everything I've said in this podcast you need to know. I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I offer one-on-one tutoring for step 1 to step 3. And I have a bunch of review classes coming up. So I have a test-taking strategies class actually this evening. All these classes over Zoom. The test-taking strategies class is for the USMLE exams. It's for step 1 all the way to step 3. It's 2.5 hours long. And then I have a biostats class tomorrow, also for step 1 to step 3. That one is a 4-hour class. The USMLE is these days. They test biostats, but most of the biostats topics, many times these days, they don't make you do any math on your exams. It's more reasoning, right? So if you want to get that reasoning down, because many people just memorize the formulas and then they notice that, man, I'm still struggling with biostats questions. Well, you know the formulas, but you don't have understanding. If you want to truly deeply understand biostats, the 4-hour class is exactly what you need. And then on Saturday, it's a 5-hour class, also for step 1 to step 3. I have a class that covers ethics, quality improvement, social sciences, healthcare systems, communications, professionalism, and things like that. Basically, these things make up about 10 to 15% of all the USMLE exams these days. So if you want to attend those, reach out to me. And these classes are not lectures. If you're expecting lectures, please don't come. These classes are pretty much almost entirely all scenarios, because those are things that are more attuned to how the USMLE presents itself. And then next week, from Monday to Saturday, I have a 25-hour step 1 class. And then the week after that, I have a 20-hour step 2 and step 3 class. So if you're interested in any of these classes, they're all going to take place over Zoom. Shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. And also help with the ERAS process, you know, rec letters, personal statements, ERAS apps, supplemental apps, mock interviews. And then I have these podcasts on the major apps, Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. And then finally, I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Actually, you know, many people said, man, Divine, I love the life lessons you put at the end of your podcast. And so I decided to make another website, divineinterventionlifelessons.com, there's actually an Apple podcast associated with it. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. And every week, I post like two podcasts that address a life lesson from a biblical perspective. I actually have more than 200 podcasts on there. Actually, I want to share a quick life lesson today. And I just want to share the importance of running your race in life without distractions. I just like to think of it like this. If you're a distracted driver, your risk of getting into an accident is extremely high, right? If you're a distracted driver, your risk of getting into an accident is extremely high, is very, very, very high, right? If you're like texting or doing whatever as you're driving, you're probably going to end your journey prematurely, right? So that's the thing. Like many people go through life being very distracted. They don't focus on the road ahead of them. They don't focus on the core things they're supposed to do with their lives. They're just distracted by all these things that don't really matter for their long-term destinies. And then they wonder why they're not making any headway, or they wonder why they seem to keep falling into a failure or the other, right? So I'm just encouraging you today. This is actually a huge, huge, huge problem amongst many people in medicine. Very, very distracted. You see sometimes patients stay in the hospital for much longer than they need to because the physicians and the medical students taking care of them, the residents taking care of them are very distracted, right? So the thing is, when you come to work, you're there to work. You're not there to chat and watch stuff on social media, right? You can do those things. There's nothing wrong with that, but do it after the job has been done, right? Just have a target, have a focus. You see many people, I kind of noticed this quite a bit, at least during my prelim year. You see a lot of people, their shift ends at 3 and they're leaving at 5 because they're just soaked by work. They're like, man, I have so much work on my plate. But check those people's lives. And they were just whiling away time the whole day. Literally, they were whiling away time the whole day, right? So just be a person that works with focus. You'll thank yourself for it. And you end up having more time to do the things you truly love. Okay, so I'll see you in episode 483. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Bye for now. Thank you.